Welcome to another edition of Radio EcoShock. We're here this Friday and every Friday from 1 to 2 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. As you may know, this is our fundraising drive time of year, and we're going to be asking you to phone 604-684-8494 and pony up some money to keep Radio EcoShock on the air and Co-op Radio going. We've got a lot for you this week. We've got our upcoming new program called Pathetic News, where we give you a roundup of some of the things that are going on around the planet. We also have a feature on Sakhalin Island, the place in faraway Russia where a lot of the world's gas and oil are going to be coming from. It's one of the world's biggest projects by Shell Oil, and it's been stalled by the Russian government, citing environmental concerns, and boy, do they have environmental problems. We'll be hearing a whole little feature on that. We've got an interview on climate change. We'll be asking the question, what is the relationship between smog and climate change? Stephen Harper says he can solve both at the same time. We'll ask UBC Professor Phil Austin, can that be done? So that's the lineup. We're going to have Pathetic News, followed by a bit of music where I hope you will phone in at 684-8494 and help the program keep going. It costs $50 for an annual membership. That's all you have to do. Then you don't have to listen to any commercials during the year. We can use every minute of Radio EcoShock to bring you the latest on what's happening to this planet. We need your support. 684-8494. Please call now or during the music following the news. Canada's new Conservative government wants to join the United States and Australia to keep up high fossil fuel use while stalling and searching for technical fixes. Maybe voters can be fooled, but natural systems cannot. Let's see how the fossil fuel binge is working for Australia. That down-under continent is suffering from a five-year drought that threatens to become permanent.
Apparently the whole planet is in danger from man-made global warming.
Bushfires are sweeping across southern Australia as we speak. Sydney has been hit with a sweltering early summer heat wave. The Times reports, quote, some farmers are asking whether farming across vast tracts of Australia has been wiped out for good by global warming, end quote. Just days ago, the Independent newspaper writes, Australia is confronting its worst drought in a century, with rampant fires devastating agricultural areas, rivers drying up, crops failing, and farmers forced to sell off their livestock, end quote. The government is pouring more and more money into relief for farmers, but there is no relief. Sheep are being sold off the dried-out lands, but the market is flooded with them. Suicide rates are up. The Independent continues, some politicians and environmental groups say that sympathetic words are not enough. They point to the increased frequency and severity of drought-causing El Niño weather patterns attributed to global warming, and to Australia's leading role in poisoning the Earth's atmosphere with greenhouse gases. You see, Australia is the world's largest exporter of dirty coal to Asia. The great brown clouds blotting out the sun over India and China come from Australia's coal mines. The government just keeps building bigger coal export facilities, more railways to the mines, more jobs and revenues, while Australia itself is one of the big victims of climate change. That country is also one of the world's biggest wheat exporters. That's food for a desperate and growing world population. But now, that crop has been threatened and hit, possibly cut in half or less. Scientists and economists have already predicted that climate change would hit the world's grain supplies hard and early. Now, it's happening. This is what happens when voters allow the fossil fuel industry to buy government representation, to keep on pumping out the carbon even while the country is wrecked by climate change. Canada wants to join that club. We'll rake in the tax revenues and pump up the job market, shipping coal out of British Columbia and dirty tar sands oil out of Alberta. We'll do it even while the rivers run dry, the salmon die, and the pine forests burn. We'll do it while the crops fail. We'll make fossil profits until we die. And now it's time for Pathetic News. What could be more pathetic than an industrialized, well-off, otherwise intelligent country setting off to murder other intelligent creatures at sea? Yes, after a worldwide whaling ban of more than 20 years, Iceland is going whaling. The whaling fleet, which apparently wasn't sunk deep enough by Paul Watson some years ago, will head out to kill minke whales and, can you believe it, even some fin whales. Fin whales remain on the IUCN endangered species list. Hardly anyone in Iceland is old enough to remember what whale meat even tastes like. Perhaps they'll use the meat for pet food like some Japanese companies did. Way to go, Iceland! We have to return to Canada to top that kind of idiocy. Except the Canadians are out to kill more people. This week, Canada led an effort to stop international works to list asbestos as a dangerous substance. The Rotterdam Convention was organized to warn countries, especially third world countries, when toxic substances were being shipped their way. Now it appears Canada has sunk the convention by keeping asbestos off the list, even though a whole generation of Canadians have died from this horrible product. Listen to this report from CBC radio program The Current.
Laurie Kazin-Allen is the coordinator for the International Ban Asbestos Secretariat.
I mean, I think that this is the death knell. I think the Rotterdam Convention is dead, and I'm very sorry to say that because I thought it was a terrific initiative, and it took 20 years to get this convention from paper into reality, and there's been an enormous amount of work by people at the Rotterdam Secretariat who've really done a startlingly wonderful job in amassing the information, in coping with the bureaucracy, and creating something that could have made a difference to the lives of people all over the world.
Are you blaming Canada, then, for killing it?
Yes. It's as simple as that. Canada has credibility as protecting the environment. You have a reputation for being a democratic and fair-thinking country, which is really very well-deserved in many aspects. I have a lot of respect for Canadians and for the Canadian way of life. And yet on this one particular issue, Canada acts out of greed and political need, and what they have done is unconscionable. They have really killed something which could have saved a lot of lives. And if I was a Canadian citizen, I would be ashamed of my government.
And this from a Canadian member of Parliament who is suffering from asbestos-caused disease.
Well, I used to work in the asbestos mines, and they were lying to us about the safety health risks of asbestos then, and I believe they continue to lie to us today. One of the cruelest things about asbestos is the long latency period. The incubation period can be 30 years. I was showing symptoms of spitting blood, etc., and I've had to have invasive bronchoscopy examinations, and they do see scarring. So I don't have asbestosis, but I do have residual effects of asbestos exposure, and I'm angry about that. The asbestos industry is the tobacco industry's evil twin. They both have made a fortune in the last century pushing a product they know full well kills. And it just makes me sick that my government is helping the asbestos industry to contaminate the rest of the world as we speak with a product that we know full well to be far too hazardous to let Canadians be exposed to at all.
That was Pat Martin. He is the NDP MP for Winnipeg Centre. He's also a former asbestos worker.
Apparently, jobs for a few asbestos miners in Quebec are more important than the lives of victims all over the world or our international reputation. We can't shut down even the dirtiest industry. How pathetic is that? The whole thing is part of a blackening role Canada is playing on the global environmental stage. Even though Environment Minister Rona Ambrose is supposed to lead the next round of talks on Kyoto, she's already on record opposing it. We don't need to control no stinking carbon. Oil sands, uberales! Oh yes, we also stomped on moves by the United Nations to ban high seas bottom trawlers that are raping the undersea mountains of the world. Even George Bush wanted the ban, but not our guys. Why is it that Newfoundland fisheries ministers always lead the charge to ruin ocean stocks? Remember another conservative, John Crosby, fighting tooth and nail to keep the Atlantic cod fishery going while the whole stock disappeared? Obviously, we need a constitutional change, a law that absolutely forbids anyone from Newfoundland from regulating the fisheries. That way, we might still have some fish left. All in all, the rest of the world is going to have to get used to Canada as the environmental black hat, the villains who oppose every move to save nature and ourselves. The only bright note, a Conservative MP has left the party in part due to Stephen Harper's position on Kyoto.
Good of you to join us in another sterling victory over the forces of evil.
If there is a single issue which demands an election to bring in someone who gives a damn about the world and Canadians, it has to be climate change. Just like Australia, we are only doing damage to ourselves. Well, that's it for Pathetic News for this week. Okay, this is your big chance to help us keep on the air. 684-8494. Give us a call here at Radio EcoShock. We'd be glad to take your membership. It's easy. We take your name. We're going to ask you how you want to pay, and you can pay several ways. No problem. We can take it over the phone, or you can mail us in something. It's no problem. And we'd be glad to have your membership in Co-op Radio. You'll be helping alternative media stay on the air, and you'll be signaling to the management here that Radio EcoShock is worthwhile. We do care about the planet. So for Gaia's sake, give us a call at 684-8494, 684-8494 to help Co-op Radio. We're going to move on to a song while you do that. It's by a guy named, I'm not supposed to tell you his name. He's a famous New York Times columnist, and the name of his group is called Uncle Wade. This song is Liberated Carbon. Enjoy, and give us a call, 684-8494.
It took 1,000 generations for our species to rise, but gathering and hunting was no way to get by. We yearned to burn more than dung and sticks. Then Satan came along and said, hey, try lighting this. He opened up the ground and showed us coal and oil. He said, come liberate some carbon, it'll make your blood boil. Liberated carbon, it'll spin your wheels. Liberated carbon, it'll nuke your meals. Liberated carbon, it'll turn your night to day. Come on and liberate some carbon, babe, it's the American way. Now I got peat swamp fossils running my TV. Satan's black label burns in my Humvee. We can light up the planet like a Christmas tree. Oh, yeah, things are getting hot, but we got AC. Liberated carbon, it'll spin your wheels. Liberated carbon, it'll nuke your meals. Liberated carbon, it'll turn your night to day. Come on and liberate some carbon, babe, it's the American way. Pump those electrons and that gasoline. No sweat or hurry, just turn on a machine. They sent an army to the desert just to keep this country free. To liberate some carbon, baby, for you and me. Liberated carbon, it'll spin your wheels. Liberated carbon, it'll nuke your meals. Liberated carbon, it'll turn your night to day. Come on and liberate some carbon, baby. Liberate some carbon, baby. Liberate some carbon, babe, it's the American way.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Join us every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Next up, we speak to a cloud expert from UBC about Stephen Harper's smoggy plan for Canada's new climate change. In the meantime, give us a call, 684-8494, to renew your membership or to become a new member. We're really looking for those new members, 684-8494. Or if you were a listener to Green Monkey Radio, we just spoke with the former host of Green Monkey, who's heading off to the island, may I say, with her new love. And she's supportive of our new program. She's glad to see an environment program coming in on Fridays from 1 to 2. So you Green Monkey listeners, also give us a call. Help support Radio EcoShock as we head out once again to save the world. 684-8494. Next up, Phil Austin from UBC speaks on clouds and climate change.
Thank you.
This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock asking the question, if we clean up city pollution and smog, will it help with climate change or will it open us up to even more heat impacts? To find out, I called a professor at a university in Canada who specializes in clouds. I'm talking with Dr. Phil Austin. He's the Associate Professor of Atmospheric Physics at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. And Dr. Austin, we've recently heard Canada's Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, announce that he was going to fight smog and climate change at the same time. And a lot of the public, including myself, thought they were very different issues. Does smog really play a role in climate change?
Yeah, I think that's been one of the most surprising things we've learned over the last 20 years or so, which is that smog, especially smog over dark water, has a cooling effect, so that because these haze particles reflect sunlight that otherwise would be hitting the ocean, they're actually saving the planet from the greenhouse effect. And it's not a small impact. If you just actually ask how much should the planet be warming up, we should have trapped about 3 watts per meter squared since we started polluting with CO2. And in fact, because of smog, we've really reflecting about half of that trapped energy. And so it's ironical, but the smog is really keeping the planet cooler than it would be if it wasn't there.
James Lovelock has talked about that and has basically said we're being protected by a wisp of smoke, as he puts it, and it could go away fairly rapidly, and then we'd feel the full impact of what we've done with the atmosphere.
That's right. So if you actually put scrubbers on, especially these coal-fired power plants in China and eastern United States and Europe, then it wouldn't take long for the particulates, the smog particles, to rain out. So they're removed by precipitation, and the atmosphere would clean itself relatively rapidly over a period of weeks. CO2 doesn't rain out, and it's up there for the next 150 years or so. So that the warming would stay, but the cooling would go. So he's absolutely right about that. If there was a major effort to clean up the air, now it's a little more complicated over the land, because the land in places like snow is already bright, and so putting smog on top of it, especially if it's dirty smog, can actually make the surface a little bit darker. But certainly the contrast between a smoggy atmosphere and clear ocean is quite stark.
Do you think that the amount of soot and particulate matter coming from our fossil fuels is being, you know, is it level? Are we getting the same amount of cooling as we're putting out heating, or is that too big a simplification?
No, I think we're doing a much better job on smog than on CO2. I mean, CO2, we aren't even trying, essentially. And so it's increasing exponentially, and it doesn't look like that's going to change. Smog, especially in a place like Vancouver, where you've got the regional GVRD, the regional authority that's produced emission testing, air quality is really actually improving a little bit. And so smog in Vancouver is less than it was, say, a decade ago. And that's true in a lot of the sort of Western industrialized countries. And that's being compensated for by places like China, in which the smog problem is much, much worse than it was a decade ago.
So what is smog?
So smog is it's kind of a chemical soup. So you gas pollutants that come out of cars, like sulfur dioxide, that come out of the tailpipes of cars. If they sit in the sunlight, they eventually cook, and they become little liquid drops of sulfate. And those little liquid drops they act as mirrors, and so those are the things that are actually scattering the light. So the part of smog that you can see that looks hazy is actually, they're actually little tiny liquid globules of sulfur.
And then where does ozone fit into that?
So ozone is a gas, and you can't see it, but it actually is a greenhouse gas. And so it absorbs thermal radiation. And so the effect of ozone at low levels is to actually heat the atmosphere. So you got the smog particles that are reflecting and cooling. You've got the ozone that is absorbing long-wave radiation and heating. Now, the other irony, of course, is that we've sort of removed ozone in the stratosphere at the same time that we're putting it into the lower part of the atmosphere. So we've got the ozone hole at high levels, and then we've got ozone pollution at low levels. And so the total amount of ozone in the atmosphere is staying approximately constant, actually.
Well, that's another beginner's question. Does the ozone that we're creating at the lower level, the troposphere, does that eventually go up there? Will it eventually help with the ozone hole?
Well, the thing about ozone at upper levels is that it essentially heats the atmosphere so much that there's a buoyant lid where you've got very warm air, tens of degrees warmer than air just beneath it, that doesn't have a lot of ozone in it, and that air then acts as almost a tarp that you can't actually penetrate. And so it's very difficult to move things from the lower atmosphere, the bottom 10 kilometers, up into the stratosphere. And so unfortunately, no, you aren't doing the upper ozone hole any good by adding ozone at lower levels. It just doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
So, as I understand it, we're not creating ozone directly with our pollution, but it's a byproduct of other things in the smog. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So it's essentially you produce these things called hydroxyl free radicals, and those then are able to separate oxygen molecules, which are O2, and form ozone molecules, which are O3. So it's pretty complicated, and there's lots of intermediate steps. And so it's not really clear which knob to turn to guarantee that you're going to reduce ozone pollution. There's some counterintuitive results, actually, where you can reduce one pollutant and actually increase the amount of ozone in the bottom part of the atmosphere.
Well, Drew Schindel, a scientist at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, he said, instead of being a tiny player, ozone can be more like 30 or 40 or even 50% of the cause of warming that we're seeing in the Arctic now. So that sounds, those are big figures, and I'd never really understood that before.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Arctic is a real amplifier for almost everything. I mean, the thing about ozone is that it acts on thermal radiation, so it doesn't matter whether it's day or night, right? It's 24 hours a day, so the Arctic night doesn't actually affect this. The greenhouse effect up there goes on 12 months a year. And also, there's very little water vapor in the Arctic atmosphere, and water vapor is an extremely potent greenhouse gas. And so the Arctic atmosphere is much, much more transparent than, say, our own atmosphere or the tropics. And that means that actually adding a little bit of absorption up there can have a very large percentage impact. So what you're seeing is you're taking a pristine atmosphere that would just let the surface cool straight to space. Almost, you know, only CO2 is the only thing getting in the way of the radiation. And then you're adding this new compound that actually is a pretty active greenhouse gas. And so in the absence of other competing effects like water vapor, it really, really does have a big, big impact.
So if we could reduce smog, say in North America at least, that really could help the Arctic, or at least mitigate some of what we're seeing up there now.
Right. So, the only problem is that it's a global, the greenhouse effect is a global phenomenon. And so at the same time, you are increasing heating in the oceans, for example, when you reduce the smog. But certainly, the other thing is that a lot of the carbon soot that goes up there coats the snow. And so you can turn bright snow into dirty gray snow. And then during the summertime, that snow actually would, or the sea ice, would absorb more radiation than it would have if there was no pollution. And so that's another fairly big effect, and you get that for free, right? If you can clean up the smog, then you remove both the ozone up there, and you would make the snow more reflective and sort of cool things that way.
And Schindel has also suggested that ozone and the whole relationship with smog is very important in trying to control methane, and he's suggesting that if we could control methane, that would be as good a way to mitigate global warming as controlling the CO2 over this next century.
That's right. So methane's another big player. Methane concentrations have more or less stabilized in the atmosphere, and I don't think anyone really knows why right now. So for whatever reason, methane is increasing at a less rapid rate than CO2. And so it may be that, I mean, it would be very nice to know why that is. Why hasn't methane increased in lockstep with carbon dioxide? But there are different processes. So methane tends to come from decaying vegetable matter or sort of animal excretions, that kind of thing. But no, if you could, you know, heating is heating, and so if you could reduce methane, then that would definitely help the problem.
And James Hansen, we were talking about particles in the atmosphere as a cooling method, and James Hansen of NASA has accepted that we might even have to take on a project where we have ships continually dispersing particles to form clouds to cool us. Am I anywhere near what he's suggesting there?
Well, I mean, there is this rainout problem if you do that from ships. So I think there's the guy who got the Nobel Prize in chemistry for the discovery of the mechanisms of ozone hole. It was awarded to three people, but Paul Crutzen was one of those. So he's recommended, I guess, within the last month or so, that you actually think about putting aerosols in the stratosphere using planes. So if you had some 747s, a lot of 747s flying up there, you could make the stratosphere essentially reflective, as it is when there's a big volcano. So you can watch El Chichon, for example, drop the average surface temperature of the planet by almost a degree, and so you could imagine doing that. The problem is, though, that eventually that sulfur would sediment out and go into the oceans and acidify the planet. Essentially, you'd be adding acid rain, really. And the other thing is that you would lose the blue sky. So there'd be it would just be like a frosted light bulb up there, in which
oh, who needs blue skies anymore?
Right. So that that might be a little depressing.
It could be. Now, you talk about aircraft. That's a big issue these days. They're saying that the radiative forcing for ozone is most sensitive up there where the airplanes are flying, and they're putting pollution in right at the 12-kilometer level. Have your studies on clouds had much to do with aircraft emissions?
Well, no, because I really do stick to the low clouds. So I don't, and for the low clouds there, we're looking more at how the particulates actually from marine organisms and that kind of thing, and from pollution, actually affect the size of the cloud particles. But I haven't really done anything with ice clouds. So ice clouds at upper levels are very hard to study, because it's very difficult to get a plane up there, and they're very very hard to observe because they're so thin. So there's a lot that isn't known about these ice clouds. It's, for example, what they form on exactly, and how many particles there are, and that kind of thing, are still kind of open questions.
So we're back to the original conundrum in a way: is pollution killing us or saving us? What's your overall impression of the direction we should go?
Well, I think that really there are other reasons to get CO2 under control, right? I mean, the acidification of the oceans is actually a huge potential problem, and the fact that that even if we didn't have a greenhouse effect, we would still have to worry about CO2 increasing ocean acidity and affecting the formation of shells on these little marine organisms and disrupting the food chain. So there's a lot of geopolitical reasons why carbon consumption should be lower. So I think whatever happens, we actually have to get CO2 reined in. And I would think that air quality can remain a kind of a decoupled issue. So I wouldn't really link them. And I think you know, sort of the appeal to a technological fix like polluting the stratosphere is pretty dangerous, because this is a system that we don't understand at all. And so I would be really hesitant to actually disturb it more than it's already being disturbed, which is a huge amount. I mean, obviously tripling carbon dioxide concentrations, which are a crucial greenhouse gas, is just a huge sort of insult to the system. And so if you compound that, then I think the odds of getting some sort of surprising, unforeseen interaction are very high, because we'll have a situation in which we have no experience. And so I don't think there's, you don't have to really be a very cautious person to think that something surprising might happen in that kind of situation.
Well, Dr. Phil Austin, thanks for talking with us today. Can we call you again the next time we get totally confused about this?
Sure. Happy to help.
All right. Well, it's a complex issue, but I think citizens need to get educated, because there are important political decisions being made, and the climate affects all of us.
Right. So I think that just appreciating how complicated it is probably should make policymakers more cautious about these big experiments that we're running on the planet.
Thanks again.
All right. Thank you.
For more on climate change, visit Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org.
Please, sir, can you spare a few minutes to save a planet?
Coming to CFRO 102.7 this fall, Radio EcoShock, Sounds for an Endangered World. Hi, I'm Alex Smith. From Vancouver, Canada, Radio EcoShock already broadcasts to thousands of listeners in North America, Europe, and Australia. Now it's coming home with green programs for BC. Nature has her own voice. Hear it with EcoShock on Co-op Radio.
Mother Earth is under the weather.
Local interviews and selections from some of the best alternative radio, plus a news roundup from BC and the world weekly.
With the boat, expose those with stocking. It's a mobile X, I'm pumping mad toxin. Dioxin, no time for relaxing. My son be basking, it's free energy blasting.
And this is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio. I'm asking you to call in at 684-8494 to renew your membership, or to sign up for a new membership to Co-op Radio. If you're on a fixed income, as I am, it's only $25 a year for your membership. For regular working people, it's $50 for your membership. And if you happen to be one of those who's pulling in a good wage, help us out with a special membership at $102.70 for the Omni membership. That really helps the station keep going. Now look, if that's a little bit too much money for you, another option, you could give us $10 a month through a special withdrawal on your checking program. We've got that set up for you easily, and that would help us keep going every month. Those monthly donations, incidentally, are really helpful for the station, because we tend to get a fair amount of money in during the membership drives, or at least enough to keep us going till the next time. But the rent comes up every month, and we've got expenses to pay every month, so those monthly memberships are really appreciated if you can do that. So give us a call at 684-8494. Let's talk over the options, get you on board Co-op Radio, and we'll keep this thing going.
With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
In late September, the world's most expensive energy project, to develop the world's largest natural gas and oil field, skidded over an embankment. Suddenly, environmental permits were denied. At the highest levels, London, Washington, and Wall Street are protesting. Like a new revolution, Putin's Russia launches an energy battle, ticking away below the radar of the latest scandal headlines in the West. Your own heat and electricity could be affected for years to come in the struggle over the world's last remaining fossil fuels. Now there is a new natural gas fight.
Get used to it.
Oh, some of the oil companies are already saying, including Shell, that they are switching to natural gas. That's where they see the future. And then the next big question is there so much natural gas out there? That's another huge question, and there is an increasing sense among some analysts that the great reserves, particularly in Russia, just may not be there. So not only are we not getting away from a fossil fuel by going to natural gas, we may be switching to one which itself is soon going to peak, or certainly not rise very much beyond where we've got now, and is once again in countries which are either playing very interesting games like Russia with the US, or else they're in countries which just flat don't like the US.
You're listening to Karen Black
and Christopher Padden
on the new Lifeboat Show here on KMUN, KTCB Community Radio, and we're talking with author Julian Darley.
The new energy hope is on the other side of the world, on a remote subarctic island off the east coast of Russia. There, Shell Oil, along with two Japanese partners, is developing Sakhalin 2 oil and gas project. The $20 billion complex of offshore oil platforms, pipelines and loading ports is 80% complete. It was expected to reach full production in 2008. All those gas delivery contracts to various companies, including Japan's largest electricity providers, have been signed. Now the consortium can't get the necessary environmental approvals to operate. Russia is reneging on the sweetheart deal given to the multinationals, including Exxon, back in 1994 by the prostrate post-communist government of Boris Yeltsin. Enriched and emboldened by their new oil wealth, Putin's government wants to take back a share in the fossil fuel bonanza waiting below the sea off Sakhalin Island. Both the White House and Downing Street have sent their complaints. Some are suggesting that all new investment with the Russians is now in question. A deal is a deal, no matter how stinking, unjust, and environmentally irresponsible it may be. The European Union has said all future investments in Russia are in doubt, and this act is, quote, providing uncertainties for the world's future energy supply. Most of you heat and perhaps cook with natural gas. Unseen, it also powers most of the new electricity generation in both Europe and North America. But American and Canadian supplies of natural gas have been in decline for over a decade. Canada, the former gas giant, is expected to run down by 2014, just 4 years after the Olympics in Vancouver. So everyone, from Beijing to Ottawa, is scrambling to lock in supplies from across the world, from Qatar, from Indonesia, and especially from Russia. The European economy could not survive a year without natural gas from Russia. That's why this fight over resources on a remote island goes right into your home. According to the BBC, quote, Sakhalin 2 is estimated to have total reserves of about 1 billion barrels of oil and 500 billion cubic meters of gas, making it one of the world's largest combined oil and gas projects, end quote. Putin's bureaucrats are withholding the permits, citing ecological concerns. Big environment groups like Friends of Earth, the World Wildlife Fund, and Greenpeace agree that Shell's mega project threatens the last Pacific Western gray whales on Earth, and 1,000 pristine salmon streams, and a wilderness wildlife haven. Without the lure of natural gas and oil, our mega corporations would never visit Sakhalin. It would be left to the 40,000 islanders who, incidentally, get none of the benefits. They live in classic Russian poverty and won't get even a bit of the gas to heat their concrete huts in the winter time. It's all for us, none for them. It's called liquid natural gas, or LNG. Of course, this gas piped to the surface has to be frozen at hundreds of degrees below zero to compress and transport it to the West in supertankers. It's the coming thing, and new LNG unloading terminals are being proposed east, west, north, and south. Shell Oil, the world's third largest company by revenues, over $300 billion a year in sales, discovered a huge natural gas field in Sakhalin, an island hundreds of miles long, just north of Japan. In fact, Japan and Russia have been disputing ownership of Sakhalin for almost 100 years. Now that it's loaded with energy, the state with the biggest nuclear arsenal wins ownership. Japan desperately needs that energy, since it has none of its own. So two of its largest super conglomerates, Mitsubishi and Mitsui, joined Shell as minority owners to strike a deal with the drunken Boris Yeltsin. That was in 1994, when the Russian treasury was too broke to pay its teachers and miners. And what a deal it was. The Russian state would get nothing until the multinational oil companies recouped all their development money, and the lease for the site was a princely $50,000 a year. Exxon also got into the action, opening an oil drilling platform at the south end of the island. Leave your car and your heated room behind. Let's travel to one of those faraway places where it all comes from. Except for a small port on the southern tip, Sakhalin is surrounded by ice for 6 months a year. Shell needed a way to pump out its product year-round, and their giant gas field was about 500 miles further north. So, they are building an underground pipeline to run the full 500 miles to the open port, the whole length of the island. And they need another pipeline system under the sea to get their oil and gas to the island terminal. The main drilling platform, one of those giant city-like structures that appear in TV documentaries, and its system of feeder pipelines, are located outside a bay that is inhabited by other sentient mammals. These are the elusive Pacific Western gray whales. The unique Pacific grays, related to those that calve off Baja and Mexico, were presumed extinct, hunted to death for their oil. But it turned out they found a remote island where they could breed unseen for over 100 years until they were rediscovered in 1977. That is the bay at Sakhalin Island. They are magnificent, intelligent ocean creatures. There are about 100 of them left.
From a vantage point above the sea, the World Wildlife Fund have been watching the whales and worrying about their survival. They wanted Sakhalin Energy to delay construction until more research could be done.
If one extra female dies each year over the next 3 years due to the construction, then that could mean the end of the whole population.
Now their breeding ground is the site of monster platforms, tankers and construction ships, oil and gas leaks and industrial chemicals.
And oil spills and discharge of toxic wastes and the dredging of sea bottom bring a lot of impact on the whales and their feeding ground and their food.
And that's before the world's biggest gas operation even starts pumping. The biggest worry, an oil spill under the ice. Ice surrounds the island half the year, yet these platforms are drawing both oil and gas from deep on the ocean bottom.
Since the oil extraction started in 1999, near the whale feeding grounds, Russian and American scientists have encountered skinny whales, the name they give to severely malnourished animals. In some years, almost half of the whales they observed were skinny. To prevent further threats to this already endangered species, environmentalists suggest a number of alterations.
The company must change the route of undersea pipelines. It's extremely important to move pipelines much more south from feeding ground.
The consortium plans to construct yet another offshore platform in Pilton Bay. Dmitry Lisitsin worries about its proposed location.
This platform is going to be very close with Pacific gray whale's habitat. And the company have to move this platform at least 12 nautical miles far from shore.
Now let's travel to Sakhalin Island itself. At the edge of the Russian Empire, the island was closed to all foreign visitors. It was the site of a secretive military base. The 40,000 islanders were the victims of splendid neglect by the Soviets, and this continued under the broken post-communist state. Most lived by subsistence fishing from the riches of the sea. Then a seeming miracle happened. Vast riches were discovered, and Western multinationals promised to inject tens of billions into the Sakhalin project. Yet today, most islanders continue to live in poverty, sidelined in the scramble for energy, power, and wealth. They won't even get a drop of gas to heat their homes in this sub-Arctic climate.
What about giving Corsica some gas?
Our role is to develop the oil and gas fields. The decision about whether the gas is taken in Russia and where it goes to is something that we have to talk to the Russian authorities about. It's not entirely our decision. We're not a gas distributor. we're going to export the oil, and we're going to sell the gas as LNG.
The profits all go to Moscow, Shell Oil, Mitsubishi, and Mitsui. The gas and the oil come to the comfortable homes and power plants of the West, and about 5,000 foreign workers have showed up to collect the paychecks.
Big energy means big corporations, and big corporations see to it that very little of the money ever reaches the community. The money comes in to the corporation, and it's sucked up to the top of the corporation, where it goes into the global financial markets, into the foreign exchanges, and as little as possible ever reaches the community. This is a standard technique, and it will be the same with LNG. Unless a miracle will suddenly happen, and I think there's zero likelihood of that, you will see that LNG is the same thing as every other kind of big energy, big corporate activity, the minimum possible labor, the minimum amounts of money remaining in the community. Meanwhile, the trick is always you internalize benefit and you externalize the drawbacks and the risks and the costs onto the public, onto the locale, onto the community. And a classic, for instance, if there's any problems, you dump it and leave, leaving the community with all the horrible problems to clean up.
Worse, the islanders' food supply and fish economy is endangered. Not only is a tanker spill inevitable, but the giant pipeline project running down the island is a recipe for lasting disaster. As a big scar is cut through the pristine landscape, it must cross more than 1,000 salmon-bearing streams. The silt of construction threatens every one of them.
It will be a big impact on salmon because salmon avoids dirty waters, muddied waters. Salmon needs the crystal clear waters to spawn.
The salmon fishery provides one-third of all the income for the islanders. And we know that these pipelines, just like the ones in Alaska, always develop leaks, large and small. The pipeline crosses 26 geological fault lines in an area famous for its seismic activity.
Located on the boundary of the Eurasian and North American plates, Sakhalin is prone to earthquakes of high magnitude. American seismologist Richard Feinberg says that the pipeline is planned to cross highly active areas.
There are 22 fault crossings on the pipeline route, which is quite a lot, 22 active fault lines.
Feinberg's findings suggest that burying the pipelines in these seismic areas could lead to a disaster.
Earthquakes and tremors are also inevitable, threatening undetected leaks or even floods of oil and gas underground and in the waters. The Russian government is quite right to withhold environmental approval in such a situation. A lot of changes have to be made, but the project is wrong and unsustainable in the first place. Remember, none of this would be happening if you and I learn how to use alternative energy and conserve, or if our economy could operate without raping foreign lands and species. Cynics speculate the environmental permits are just chess pieces in a geopolitical game to rewrite ownership of Russian natural resources. Through moves like jailing the head of Yuko Oil, Putin is reasserting public ownership of the country's fossil fuel wealth. And he's not afraid to anger the largest multinationals in the world, because hardly anyone can operate now or in the future without Russian natural gas. This is so important. Natural gas deals are made by heads of state. Last summer, Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper's priority on meeting Putin for the first time was to seal a deal for $1 billion worth of gas for Canada. When German Chancellor Angela Merkel went calling, she was glad to come back with another gas contract, gas from the Stockman field, originally intended for the U.S. market. It's a free-for-all of desperate energy buying. Meanwhile, Bush's regime seems intent on recreating aspects of the Cold War. They have sanctioned the Russian state arms company, Rosoboron Export, and other big Russian companies for selling arms and reactors to Iran. That's when the American gas contracts disappeared to the Germans. It's hardball with home heating and brinksmanship with fuel for electricity plants. The Russians have also denied permits to the American giant ExxonMobil, who wanted to expand their Sakhalin 1 project on the island. And they have protested Shell's new claims that Sakhalin 2 cost $20 billion to develop, double the original estimate. Why should they care? Because Shell apparently promised the Russian state gas company, Gazprom, a 25% buy-in in exchange for rights in other Arctic gas and oil fields. Now the Russians have to pony up twice as much resources just to get back in at Sakhalin. No wonder they're upset. Meanwhile, environmentalists are trying to shut bank doors against further financing of Shell's Sakhalin monster project. The Shell consortium, called Sakhalin Energy, applied for a $300 million loan from the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the EBRD. That institution was set up in 1991 with taxpayers' money to help rebuild the former Soviet republics after the fall. Now Shell, with tens of billions of profits lately, want the taxpayers to fund their environmentally damaging project at Sakhalin. Groups like Friends of Earth are calling foul and saying no. You can see a good video about all this and see the island's beauty and sadness for yourself in a video called Sakhalin's Black Tears. It's from the CEE Bankwatch Network, released January 2006. Go to Google Video and search for Sakhalin, spelled S-A-K-H-A-L-I-N. It's 17 minutes long, and you will feel you have been there. Hopefully, viewers will also see a million dark figures lurking in the background of every frame of this story. Ourselves. Because it's the same all over the world. Wherever oil and gas industry lands, the maximum amount of energy and profits go out, the bare minimum stays in the community. I mean, that's capitalism, folks, and the pollution lingers long after the party is over. In Nigeria, the Ogoni tribe living among the wells, pipelines, and pollution were kept impoverished. The greatest Ogoni spokesman and environmental protester was murdered by the police to stop criticism of the Shell project there. In Saudi Arabia, the Shiites who live in the oil fields watch the wealth pumped out to the Sunni royal family, often Riyadh. The people of Venezuela may finally get a piece of the pie, despite CIA attempts to install oil executives into the government instead of the popular Hugo Chavez. Natural gas was pumped out of Bolivia for years in the midst of abject poverty for the people. It's energy colonization. It's dangerous and destabilizing. We can expect terrorism and wars to come.
The natural gas itself is going to come from faraway places, often in Africa and in the Middle East and other places which may well not be friendly towards the US, and that is going to cause them problems, because once you hook yourself into natural gas, it's a very long-term thing, often requiring 20 to 30 year contracts. You will then find you're then dependent on these other countries, and that will invite military, up to and including military occupation, if not other forms of coercion, trade coercion, and so forth. So this is one of the reasons it has very nasty geopolitical consequences, and doesn't do anything to reduce your demand on fossil fuels either.
And it all feeds the coming climate chaos.
When will this insanity end?
These are our energy crimes. We take what we need and claim we don't know what oil addiction costs people and the environment.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see this.
This report is from Radio EcoShock, the net's only all-environment radio station, at www.ecoshock.org, E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Tune in free. We need your help to keep on digging up the dirt on the big corporations and on what's going on with the climate of the world, the energy, the oceans, the forests, the whole thing. Call us at 684-8494. This is Alex Smith asking for your support. Join Co-op Radio. It's cheap and it's really worth it. 684-8494. Well, we're going to go out with a piece done by Lisa Walker from her album Grooved Whale. It's called Boogie Wave. And we'll do this out of respect for the ocean species that are out there. Hopefully they'll keep on living after we've burned up the rest of the world with climate change, unless we get smart all of a sudden and do something about it. So this is for the whales and for all the people who love whales. It's called Boogie Wave with Lisa Walker. Give us a call while it's playing at 684-8494 and help us keep going on the air with Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver.
Thank you.
Thank you.